kind of things. So these are, you know, two related but different arguments. But, you know, within the kind of context of arguing this within the courts, obviously civil libertarian framework, it prevails and is more useful in that kind of context, albeit, I guess a kind of a like attenuated scope of what we're kind of talking about. So you mentioned the USA Patriot Act, and I think that's, you know, one place where the government has kind of started to encroach on the privacy rights of individuals over the past decade and a half. And new laws, such as I mentioned, the TSA Modernization Act, and also the Building America's Trust Act, which I kind of find a little bit of a funny name because it implies that America has no trust currently, which you might wonder why.
It just needs a little work.
Right. Yeah. It just needs to get built up, you know, by apparently categorizing people as they cross the border. And this applies to U.S. citizens and non-U.S. citizens alike. So this is a bill that's up before the 115th Congress. It was introduced in the Senate in August, and it proposes basically collecting biometrics on border crossings and at airports from U.S. citizens and non-U.S. citizens alike. So this, in combination with a TSA Modernization Act, it has this potential to basically collect as much information on ourselves, or whether it be from facial recognition technologies or from other biometric identifiers as possible. So yeah, that's kind of what we're starting to deal with. And of course, these technologies are all new, right? Facial recognition hasn't been reliable very much until very recently. And it's still, you know, in some cases, very unreliable. We've seen the bias that these algorithms can exhibit. There's been cases where the Microsoft, I think it was, facial recognition technology was driven by like a data set that was kind of feed data. So that these algorithms have to be trained on some amount of data first before they're applied, right? It has to have a set of faces that you can check against. And because these set of faces were predominantly white faces, the seed data was predominantly white faces that it was trained on, then the outcome was that these algorithms would actually make kind of racist assumptions about people that are not, and we've seen this a lot in recent years. So these algorithms are really kind of unreliable. They're just starting to get more reliable, like better, so-called better, in recognizing faces and recognizing what, you know, a human from a cat or you know, these different kind of things. And so as the technologies are getting more accurate, the application of these technologies are starting to become used by law enforcement, by customs and border protection, quote unquote, by TSA. And so, yeah, we have these kind of laws that are, you know, attempting to broaden the scope of these technologies right as they're getting to the point of reliability, right as they can be used. The government just comes in and says they should be used, which is a real problem.
I fell down a wormhole when you were mentioning that. I found an article about from 2015 about Google Photos tagging two African Americans as gorillas using the facial recognition software. And
yeah,
it's kind of
right.
Like problematic about, like, question is, like, is that because of the focus, or did some programmer get in there and be like, hey, I'm a racist, I'm going to make this actually apply in this manner?
Yeah, I don't know the details of it, but I was aware of that case. And I think that this, you know, has, you know, kind of gets into algorithmic bias in general. And when people kind of just assume that it's an algorithm. So how could it be faulted? It's just math. And that's a really kind of problematic mindset, because algorithms are, you know, rife with human bias. They're rife with a programmer's bias, as you mentioned. They're rife with problems in seed data. They are often used to supplant laws in a lot of cases. So for instance, supplant
like actual evidence,
the general judgment of people. So like you have mandatory sentencing guidelines that are used based on a predictive algorithm for recidivism, for, you know, how likely someone is to commit a crime again. And as ProPublica found out in a study last year, these algorithms are extremely racially biased and will show that someone who is African-American will have, you know, based on like, you know, based on nothing but their skin color, will be shown to have much higher rates of recidivism. It's actually illegal to ask someone like, you know, to actually build a racial bias into these algorithms because of discrimination law. So what they'll do is they'll use questionnaires before coming up before the judge in order to see if they were eligible for early release or et cetera. And they'll use questions. Some of the questions are, for instance, has anyone in your family ever been convicted of a crime? Mm-hmm. Do you live in a high crime neighborhood? And these kind of questions aren't directly asking your race, but what they're doing is they're proxies for race, because African Americans are disproportionately living in because of the, you know,
over-policing, flawed, for instance,
so-called criminal justice system, you know, because of over-policing, because of criminalization of black bodies in criminalized neighborhoods, are living in so-called high crime neighborhoods. And so you have this as a proxy for race, even though they don't actually ask, are you African American or not? And don't use that directly as a question on these questionnaires. So it's really problematic. And I guess that kind of is a tangent to biometric data, but it kind of feeds into this whole idea of algorithmic bias, which facial recognition in policing definitely has. There's a really great book by Andrew Guthrie Ferguson called The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement, and goes into some of these things, some of the ways that police are using algorithms, black neighborhoods, black bodies. And one of the ways they do it is that they will disproportionately target neighborhoods which have had arrests, say drug arrests before. So they use the seed data of drug arrests to populate a map to determine where to target their policing efforts next. And then they go into those neighborhoods, make more arrests, and then that is in the next iteration used to, you know, as seed data to again target those exact same neighborhoods. So it's a self kind of perpetuating reinforcement cycle that is used in this case in order to kind of promote already systematic violence and systematic racism in policing. And so, like, you know, you can imagine a world where instead of them going into black neighborhoods and using that as seed data, they went on Wall Street and busted anyone with some coke in their pockets. And that will be used as seed data to actually kind of, you know, all these billionaires that are on Wall Street that are actually, you know, they're using cocaine, they'll be busted. So the next iteration that, you know, they'll have a reinforcement mechanism that actually targets not black bodies, not black neighborhoods, but the, you know, rich and wealthy on Wall Street. And that's not happening. And I think that's not happening for obvious reasons.
Bringing up and bringing out what the potential applications and like dangers of that sort of approach to applying data that they've collected. It kind of, this is tangential also, just tit for tat. In California in 2004, the voters passed passed Proposition 69. It was put up to the voters, and it was entitled the DNA Fingerprint Unsolved Crime and Innocence Protection Act. And a lot of the data that was supposedly being pulled in from this, the DNA, was to help to more quickly have DNA accessible for rape kits and things like that, or sexual assault kits. But it basically said that anyone who was arrested of a felony would have their DNA collected. Not anyone who is convicted of a felony, but anyone who is arrested would necessarily – their DNA would become a part of a database that would later be used to attempt to solve crimes, which, yeah, I don't know. The logic is, you know, you're not going to get picked up for a crime and have a false positive if you're not related to some sort of illegal activity. But just the fact that coming in contact with law enforcement – even if that charge doesn't stick, means that you suddenly become a part of this database, is just creepy as fuck. Like, it's a total invasion of people's privacy, like literally bodily privacy. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my And talking about like bringing it back to facial recognition, UK police actually, you know, scanned the faces of 90,000 festival goers in a Download Festival, it was called. And then checked each of those faces against well-known wanted criminals across the country. So this is happening to, you know, just as if you're walking into a festival, for instance. The kind of facial recognition technologies and biometric technologies that are being used at airports are implemented so far right now as part of the pre-check program. So, you know how if you go into an airport, there's, you know, the line where the rest of us dregs, the proles, basically everyone, you know, has to wait in line. And then there's this fast lane that you see these people going through. And that's called pre-check, the pre-check line. And so if you're on the pre-check line, basically into the pre-check program, it's also called global access, is to, you basically have to go through some kind of a screening process, and you have to get your fingerprint taken as part of a mandatory background check. And that's how biometrics are currently used at airports. And as part of a trial program last year, the airports in Denver and Atlanta were actually using this pre-check data to take fingerprints at the airport itself as part of the entry. So instead of it just being used for the mandatory background check in the initial kind of stage, the pre-check was used as an authentication when going through the airports. Yeah, they said that this data wouldn't be stored, but slowly we've seen that this data is actually like without congressional authorization, without all these kind of like so-called checks and balances that are always, you know, supposed to be at play, have expanded this program. And so the Department of Homeland Security is trying to expand these programs and screen everyone that's in an airport or everyone that's traveling from one location to another. So this, you know, the expansion of these programs has started. As people kind of stand up to it, it's going to continue. So the vendor that runs the pre-check program is a company called Idemia. And they run this program, pre-check, at airports, but they also offer this kind of expedited entry program for concerts and stadiums across the country. So you'll have these biometric scanners being installed and facial recognition technologies being installed to track fans as they move throughout a stadium or they attend a concert. And so these, as I said, these technologies are being used to encroach on people's daily lives much more than they were able to do before these technologies were really reliable. So because of the reliability technologies, immediately you see them being picked up by governments trying to use them on their own populations. It's really telling that this happens without any real congressional debate, because what you see is that there's an opportunistic use of these technologies immediately as they become available. And so, you know, the civil liberties implications of these are being brought up by certain groups, but they're, you know, not going undergoing a great deal of scrutiny within the decision-making bodies of the country themselves. So that's something to be concerned about. And it has to be, I mean, I think that, like, it's actually a kind of hard thing to bring up, because these issues become very abstract. People don't really get worked up about these issues as much as they do other issues that rightfully, like, you know.
Like what?
What I'm trying to say is, like, I'm trying to,
like the collection, like, of phone metadata, for instance?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, or, you know, just kind of in general, other privacy. But, like, I think that, like, it's kind of an abstract issue because people don't really think about it, and it's hard to, like, kind of point to a specific instance where to say, like, this is facial recognition technology being used poorly, and this is, like, going to be something that really, like, kind of a spark that sets the fire to. And this is kind of like an abstract issue that people have a hard time relating to, and that's why it's pretty hard to actually connect with people and try to get them to, like, build a movement around it or oppose it, other than in the kind of general, you know, strain of opposing increasing government encroachment on our privacy.
Well, okay. Well, how about like we, you know, use our imagination a little bit, and then we can backpedal from there. In 2015, over 22 million Social Security numbers were stolen, right? People have been able to hack into these large databases with people's voter information, with people's medical records, all these things that are supposedly, you know, there's actually laws protecting the, like, these types of information. you know, for the disclosure of people's personal medical records, for instance. And yet the databases where these have been held, including government databases as well as private vendor databases, have been hacked by outside parties with the information released and posted elsewhere. Now, with biometric data being able to be released and with biometrics being connected with all sorts of other means of securing devices or securing accounts, if this is all being databased, that's putting it in one place where it can be broken out and looted. It seems like the collection of and centralization of databases of people's biometric information is just increasing the likelihood of more and more intense scenarios of identity theft. Does that seem like a reasonable concern to broach?
Yeah, for sure. The more data that they store in centralized locations, the bigger a target is for hackers. And so you'll have hackers breaking into these databases, getting lots of information on lots of people, because that data is valuable. It's valuable increasingly as a means of identification and authorization. If you're able to board an airplane just by having your fingerprint or face scanned, then you can imagine scenarios where this data is very valuable, that can be used by, you know, identity thieves to possibly do pre-check or whatever, and to board airplanes. It's pretty easy to create a mold of a fingerprint, for instance. So you can definitely see this data being valuable and it becoming an increasing target for criminal elements that want to steal identity. And, you know, you see that the security mechanisms that are built into government databases are not that great. The Office of Personnel Management breach in 2015, as you mentioned, released the data of thousands of employees, possibly hundreds of thousands of employees of the federal government. The data breaches that we have seen over time have gotten larger and larger, and that trend is likely to continue. We don't see the security mechanisms on this data being properly locked down. Our information, we are forced to submit it to government agencies, and then they are completely unaccountable with what they do with it. Over and over, we see that the state, when they employ these technologies, present them as an infallible front. But the infallibility of it is only based on their monopoly on force, on the fact that we have identification of a face, and then you come in with like a SWAT team, and that looks like, look, we have, they can present an argument that's an infallible kind of process that brought them to criminalize this person. But you know, when you have large databases that are being cracked by that have information on federal employees, the entire federal government's employee database, in a huge breach, then it kind of like shatters that illusion of these infallible technologies that are employed by the state, which is kind of, in a weird way, encouraging, because it means that this facade that they have tried to establish, this tale that they tell themselves of, the inevitability of the logic of the state population, is actually a false story. It's kind of a ruse. But in this case, they don't employ the proper protections on our own data that we're forced to give them when we, say, board an airplane, when we attend a concert, when we go to a sports event. So what are they protecting and how are they protecting it? This data is often even not known to us. These are kind of secrets that the secrets of trade that they actually use internally, where they don't let it known how these databases are locked down. It's not transparent to us how our data is actually being used, even though we're forced to submit this data to them. So that's another kind of element of concern, is that there's a huge lack of transparency in what's going on with our data once we've given it to them. And often, especially when it's being stored by private third-party contractors, the government itself is under a contractual obligation not to release that data because of non-disclosure agreements. State Freedom of Information Act requests and Federal Freedom of Information Act requests have been denied because of NDA agreements that they were forced to sign. For instance, in New York, the teachers had to go through this value-added system where they were ranked based on the performance of their pupils. And if pupils performed poorly, the teachers could not be given a raise, could be penalized or fired. And the thing is that this is a clear proxy for class. So if you have a pupil who is of a lower economic status, then they will, not perform on average as well as someone who is of a higher economic status. And so this, basically is being used teachers that were teaching poor kids. And when there was a Freedom of Information Act request filed on how this process works, because it was behind an NDA with a private third-party contractor, they couldn't actually look at how that data was being used. So that's really concerning, because we don't know what's happening behind the scenes with our own data, because increasingly this data is actually, you know, controlling various aspects of our lives and becoming more important about how we actually live in our society.
So one thing, just to kind of jump back for a second, well, no, maybe not. So we've talked about a few different applications that the government uses for collecting, or why they would collect facial recognition data. Police forces have been using them, for instance, to you mentioned to track down people allegedly guilty of crimes, to determine also the identities of people participating in street demonstrations is another thing. For instance, I know, like, what was it, J19 or something like that? There was a massive demonstration in London in 99 in the summer, the Carnival Against Capitalism. And London being one of the most surveilled cities around the world, a few years after the demonstrations, where people swarmed through different parts of the financial district causing havoc and chaos of various sorts, various and sundry and joyous sorts. A few years later, people started getting arrested based on facial recognition from cameras all around. I think a lot of that was, I mean, considering how long ago it was, a lot of that was probably actually officers going through databases and comparing photographs. But with that sort of ubiquity of cameras everywhere, it seems like that would be a much more likely scenario. A few years back in Asheville, there were street demonstrations in response to the police killing of Jai Williams, arguably an unarmed black man who was killed at the Deverview Apartments by an officer. People received warrants in names matching Facebook accounts within a couple of weeks afterwards who had participated in some of the street demonstrations, the unpermitted demonstrations where people took the streets. Some activists have speculated that the police just sat there and matched photos posted on Facebook with tags that people had done, like tagging accounts to accounts, and that they filed the warrants based on the information provided on the social media platform. But have you heard about this sort of thing being a common practice? And is there, like, I've heard that Facebook has a specific login ability for law enforcement where they can get access to information from people's accounts without warrants. But is facial recognition off of social media a pretty common practice that you know of?
Yeah, and it's also something that they encourage with their real names policy. So, for instance, you'll see when you log in, who you recognize, and they'll say, "Is this the real name of the person that you recognize?" So they use the real names policy to kind of like enforce or to use others snitch on you, basically, at least to snitch on you in the respect of revealing your real name to Facebook. And so, yeah, Facebook is, I mean, true to its name, kind of become a platform for law enforcement. And it's really kind of true that, I mean, in the past, law enforcement has used, you know, manual matching type, you know, basically taking photos that were seen or taken on a site of a crime and manually matching up against a criminal database by officers just going through photos and seeing who they think this person matches up to. But, you know, now this is kind of coming under the rubric of facial recognition algorithms. It's really concerning. A study by researchers at Georgetown University's Center for Privacy and Technology estimates that about half of American adults, 117 million Americans, are in some kind of a law enforcement-based recognition network, as they term it. So, you know, it's either accessible via a police database or a database by some contractor that the police can readily access. And yeah, this is, you know, come, you know, it just goes to show that this is not just a technology that's used against potential criminals, but it's actually, you know, reaching into the ganglia of social life in the US. Kind of argument against this goes, well, you know, this is really bad because if you authoritarian use this, then it can be, a real kind of problem for those that oppose those authoritarian regimes. But, you know, as we've seen, even in societies which are seen as free societies, arguably, like our own, arguably, these technologies are used against, you know, we know that food not bombs was added to a terrorist watch list, things like that. And we see this kind of habitually used. So these databases and, you know, are really kind of come to bear against activists, against elements that are inconvenient for the government in general. And we see this time and time again. And if the database of faces is actually half of all Americans, then they really have a lot of material in which to draw from to make a match. So that's something that's really concerning for the future of basically protest, for the future of having a ability to oppose government programs, to oppose governments in general, to resist the programs that they put in place. So that's something that's I think going to become more and more of an issue as time goes on. One of the really concerning technologies that they have been exploring in general, researchers have been exploring, not so much as far as I know, police, has been something called disguised face identification. So using the general shape of someone's face, if they're masked up, if they have a scarf or a ball cap or whatever, disguising their face, they can use the general shape of their face in different like angles, like where their cheekbones are and, you know, whether their chin comes to a point or not, and things like that, in order to identify the face of someone who you know, against their actual database of people that aren't masked up. And so that's something that is really going to be something of concern, and something that those that wish to be anonymous at protests have to kind of think about and formulate strategies in order to counter. I think there are some strategies that are promising in that respect. For instance, if you want to remain anonymous at a protest, then instead of just wearing a bandana or wearing a scarf around your face, the less points of identification that you reveal, the better, right? You can actually put on goggles or, you know, the more kind of disguised you are, the better in general, in order to counter the shape of your face kind of things. Use something like a no face chrome mask. And this is like a thing that basically you can see out of, but when someone looks at you, it just reflects back. A neat little technology that those that wish to be anonymous at protests can utilize in order to counter some of these facial recognition technologies. There are also kind of other interesting projects, which I think are more art-oriented than practical. There is this artist that develops these fabrics that are used to trick or used to confuse facial recognition technologies. He's a Berlin-based artist and technologist, Adam Harvey. These bandanas that kind of might look like, you know, small little bits of faces that really kind of confuse the facial recognition technologies that are employed. I think this is kind of interesting as a piece of art, but it might, you know, under practical strain, not be that great as a subversion technique, because a computer can just say, I'm confused, and then refer back to a human to actually do the identification. Whereas if you use something that, you know, you just can't, you know, can't actually get useful data out of, like a face mask that covers your entire face, then that might be a more practical solution.
Can you break down really specifically, as far as you know, like how does facial recognition tend to work? How does the, like what points on the face does the computer like link together to recognize, or what measurements does it make to verify identity? I'm sure there's a couple of different approaches that programs use, but do you know about this?
Yeah, and I think that's a really complicated question, because one thing that we know is that humans are really good at identifying faces. When we look at each other, we can immediately identify someone that we know. If you're looking in a crowd of thousands of people, then it's actually really, the human mind is really quick at picking out people that, oh, I know that person, that person, that person. So it's kind of a, I would call like evolutionary trait that we have developed in order to kind of survive in social groups, right? And because we're optimized to do this in some way, it's taken a long time for computers to get there. And the different characteristics they might look at, which we kind of, like when we look at another person's face, we automatically just kind of figure out based on our own, you know, inherent ability to recognize faces in most cases. You know, these might include, you know, the shape of the chin, how high out the cheekbones are, or like the shape of your eyes, the corners of your mouth, where those end, you know, like if they're like pointed up or down, other like kind of things that we don't even think about because we take for granted most of the time, how good our brains are at doing this. And so computers do this, I think, is a really kind of complicated question, because it means that we have to like break down every way that the human brain has been optimized to kind of think about this problem, to think about how we recognize others. So that's something that computers have just started to get better at. And I think that like this is one of those cases where the technology is used for evil, but you can imagine it actually being right. You know, if you are going through footage of an event and you want to anonymize people, then what better way to do it than to know where the faces actually are? So you have a computer program that could identify faces in a crowd and then just, you know, smear them like automatically, before it's actually uploaded as footage, you know, in a news story or whatever. So this can, you know, this can technology, as in most cases, the technology is really neutral, but the way that it's used is developed and pursued along lines which increase the ability for surveillance to happen. And so that's kind of how it's being pursued and how it's being used.
So it's interesting that you mentioned the, what was the name of that German artist?
Yeah, his name,
or the artist
is
based in Germany. Yeah, he had done some really interesting things with making a burqa or a sweatshirt, like a hoodie, that incorporated material that would like diffuse heat patterns in case someone was looking through a drone or something like that at someone. It would sort of invisibilize the portions that were covered by that material. He's also done Faraday cage pockets on sweatshirts. It's all kind of like, yeah, expensive and seems like high fashion more than actually applicable in a lot of ways, but kind of cool design ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like a lot of these things may start as kind of interesting surveillance fashion, but then people, maybe this artist, maybe other people, find applicability in it and are able to develop something new that uses the previous iteration for more practical purposes. So that's kind of something that, you know, I think is useful. I think that like a lot of the kind of stuff that Adam Harvey is doing is used to, you know, not necessarily practically obfuscate your face if you're like doing a crime or something, but, you know, because if you're, you know, if there's footage of you doing a crime, then, you know, there's like the obfuscation of faces because you're wearing a bandana. They'll just kind of black out the bandana and then they'll use a human to try to recognize who you are. But a lot of it is kind of like, oh, that's interesting. It kind of makes you think about how we recognize faces and photos, you know, just by ourselves and with our own brains, and you know, brings up interesting kind of questions about the role of surveillance in general. So I think that like that's his focus in general. Yeah, and he's spoken at the Chaos Communication Congress. It's more of a like kind of interesting technology project than a practical use in keeping anonymous.
I'd also seen reports that different sorts of, and this might be the same kind of thing with like practicality, or they would just like swap out once a computer can't figure out where the face is, then swapping it out for a human being, which at least, you know, it's giving someone a unionized job. That's pretty cool, right? Full employment. But different makeup patterns for obfuscating.
Hair.
Yeah.
Hair.
A second nose.
No. 15 eyes.
Yeah. I mean, but some of this stuff is you know, available at makeup stores or at, you know, costume shops. You know, so
right.
things that do change the shape of your face. And I'd prefer if we don't talk about doing crime, but doing freedom, please, or a crime called freedom. So when doing freedom.
All suggestions, I'm just saying if one wishes to do this.
Yeah, hypothetically.
hypothetically.
But so there is another method besides makeup that I'd heard about where for infrared cameras, the application of lights from different angles that might obscure the camera's ability to recognize your face. Is that an approach that's actually practicable when dealing with infrared cameras?
So there are some cameras which are blinded by infrared light. There are like hats that are sold that basically blind a certain array of cameras. But that means that there are other cameras that aren't going to, they act more like the human eye, that aren't going to be blinded by this. So I think that your mileage may vary when it comes to like infrared blinding flashlights, which is what a lot of these kind of things amount to.
Okay. Is there a good place in your estimation for people that are curious about the advancements in this kind of technology and pushback? Is there a good place for people to put their attention? Are there any good groups? I know the ACLU covers topics like this. I know the Electronic Frontier Foundation at times has been known to make statements on things like this.
Yeah, I think that the EFF blog is a great place to kind of look for the latest in how this technology is developing Turian point of view. You know, this is something that EFF tracks very closely and writes about quite a bit. So, yeah, that's somewhere that you can just go to EFF.org and check out. And, yeah, and in general, I think that, like, there are other sites that are a little bit more kind of, I guess, on the hypothetical, theoretical edge of things. I think, like, you know, a lot of times when interesting, you know, technologies, privacy and, you know, human rights, these kind of things will show up on blogs like Boing Boing. BoingBoing.net has a lot of, like, really kind of interesting ways in which emerging technologies are used and with a focus on privacy and security. So that's another kind of place where you might find some of these emerging technologies.
Mad shout out to Cory Doctorow. What?
Yeah.
Have you read Walk Away?
No, that's a newer one, right?
Yeah, it's pretty entertaining. I didn't finish it. It was a very big book, and I got distracted by other things. But what I read was about half of it was quite entertaining.
I'm trying to remember this one site. It's like The Futurist or like...
Is it Singularity2050.com? The Futurist? Whoa! Was it the album by Robert Downey Jr.? Released in 2004 called The Futurist? I had no idea.
I don't believe it was.
Oh, he's so pouty on the cover.
Robert Downey Jr. had an album?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if he... It's from Sony Classical. Yeah. He had a song play during his 2005 film Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. His song Broken played at the end of it. During the end. Yeah. Wow, The Futurist. He's got a song on there written by Charlie Chaplin. The hell?
I think it was... You know, he played in a biopic about Charlie Chaplin in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really good film.
So, yeah. Surprisingly good. People don't give it enough credit. Huh. Really sad. It's a really sad film.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. I guess this is a song about Charlie Chaplin called Smile that was written or composed by him. Different people did lyrics. Nat King Cole performed it. But so... Bob Downey... Did his little homage again. Wow.
Do 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 do.
Any luck?
No, it's like a feature probably not worth mentioning if I can't find it.
Charlie Chaplin got knighted. I didn't know that. I'm just finding so much on Wikipedia. Wow.
Exported from the U.S. Not exported. Deported from the U.S. and knighted by the U.K.
Yeah. Full disclosure, William is employed by the EFF, which he has name-dropped. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to chat about this, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to hear more of these chats or our weekly radio show on anarchist actions and ideas, check out thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org.
Hide the planet! Hide the planet!
Worse than that, he dead, Jim. Dead, Jim. It's worse than that, he dead, Jim. Dead, Jim. Dead.
Well, it's life.
life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow. Scrape them off, Jim.
Star Trekking across the universe.
On the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk.
Star Trekking across the universe.
Life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow.
You can't change your script, Jim. I'll see you, Jimmy.
It's worse than that is physics, Jim.
Bridge to engine room, warp factor 9.
Oh, if I give it any more, she'll blow up.
Yeah.
Bye.